Digital 410 proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Henry Sledge.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II podcast. And even though for some of us it feels like a Sunday, happily for everybody, it's a Monday. And we are back once again live from the Digital 410 studios. And joining us, as always, Mr. Henry Sledge, Jeff Copsetta. And we're excited for tonight's guest coming on to promote his new book, The Long March Home, author Mr. Marcus Brotherton. Gentlemen, how is everybody doing tonight?
Doing fantastic. Glad to be here.
Happy. Yeah, this is going to be a great episode.
Now, just to give everybody a fair warning before Marcus comes on, Jeff gave us the heads up. If his audio starts to drop out or if he vanishes completely, that's because he's looking down the barrel of a hailstorm right out his window. And so we're got to deal with his Texas internet tonight. But Marcus, sir, how are you doing?
Doing well, thanks. Yeah, great to be here.
And we appreciate you taking time out of your Monday night to come on and hang out with us. We're excited to discuss your book. And we're always excited to see new content coming down the line in the World War II content realm. So if you actually, I was thinking maybe for the uninitiated, before we get into your book, we give a brief background on the Battlefield Opinions and the Bataan Death March. You know, we all know that most people who aren't as up to date on World War II as we do, they all think, okay, Pearl Harbor, and Pearl Harbor was it. That's what we got us into the war as far as Japan goes. They attacked Pearl Harbor, sank some ships, and we got in a battle in the thick of things, but that wasn't exactly it, because while Pearl Harbor attack was going on, the Japanese was initiating multiple attacks, multiple fronts, and along came the Philippines. So maybe we should start off with dipping our toe a little bit into the Battle of the Philippines and the Bataan Death March, and then we'll get right into your book.
Yeah, it's really key to keep in mind. You know, European theater gets a lot more attention, I would say, than the Pacific, and there's some reasons for that. And it's not, we're not trying to pit the two theaters against one another. I think that's key as well.
Sure.
My passion is I just want people to be aware of the Pacific and what happened over there. And you know, a lot of good people give a whole lot of blood, sweat, and tears. So, yeah, the Philippines was an American protectorate at the time. So there were many, maybe 20,000 troops over there, and then they were allied with the Filipino troops. So about 10 hours after Pearl Harbor was attacked, the Philippines are attacked as well. And it's a fight. It's a fight. And so the troops fight back, but they are outgunned and outmanned, and most of the fleet has been destroyed at Pearl Harbor, so they can't get resupplied. They can't get reinforcements to come. So they're kind of inched back and back, and finally they find themselves with their backs against the sea, and there's just nowhere to go. So that's what leads to it all.
And I think one of the things you said, outgunned, is a very, very important aspect of this. People know from watching the Pacific and reading the books and studying that, yes, when the Marine Corps got sent down to the Pacific, we were fighting with, a lot of World War One materials, but they did have some new equipment, whereas in the Philippines, they were, you know, literally just forces that were kind of pre-war, especially our participation, with the exception of Lend-Lease. They had antiquated weapons, antiquated gear. They were just kind of down there, as you said, as a protectorate. They didn't have top-of-line, you know, firearms, gear, plethora of ammunition. And so what they had kind of stationary is what they had when they were stuck fending themselves off for all this time.
Yeah, it was when the troops initially got over there, you know, it was before Pearl Harbor. And the I did a nonfiction book last year called Bright and Blinding Sun. And the atmosphere in the Philippines during that time was kind of a big party.
Yeah.
The war, it's not going to come to us, surely. And while we're here, you know, we can get a cheap beer and have a good time. It was swell duty being sent to the Philippines. It was kind of like if you've been in the service for a while, they called them Asiatics or Asiatics.
Mm-hmm.
They're often trying to get there enjoy a grass skirt and a drink under the sun. That was the idea. And then a lot of these guys were just brand new. The book I did last year, Bright and Blinding Sun, he was Joe Johnson, he was only 14 when he enlisted. He fibbed about his age and kind of snuck under the radar. So he was just as green as could be. And a lot of the troops, they were maybe, you know, 18, 19, but they none of them had seen any action, of course.
It's amazing how as time goes by, we hear more and more of these stories, you know, as more stories come to light, more, you know, letters, paperwork get undug. We find cases, Sidney Phillips, he was there, he turned 16 on Guadalcanal, and or turned 18 on Guadalcanal, and how many young men enlisted with the help of their parents. And I often joke, you know, back in 1942, we had 15, 16, 17-year-olds fighting to save our planet, and nowadays I can't get a 16-year-old to mow the grass without attitude. So it's just amazing how far we've come along as far as responsibility and patriotism and willing to do your part at such a young age.
Henry, how old was your dad when he was sent over there?
Marcus, he enlisted at 19. You know, he wanted to enlist sooner, but my grandparents implored him to go to officer training. So he did the Georgia Tech officer training program, then flunked himself out. So when he actually enlisted and went in as an enlisted Marine, he was 19.
Yeah.
And then, as Don said, you know, Sid went in at 17 and turned 18 on Guadalcanal.
Yeah, I think back to what I was doing at 18 or 19, and I mean, what were you guys doing at 18 or 19?
I grew up in the 90s, and I was trained not to talk about those things on video and or recording, so I'll refrain from what I was told when I was 18 in this aspect.
It's crazy to think that, you know, kind of the weight of the world is on your shoulders at that age.
Right. Absolutely. Jeff, you joined. Well, how old were you when you joined up the service?
I was 17, but I turned 18 2 weeks before basic and turned 21 in Baghdad.
And so, I mean, you could definitely speak to being that age. You know, here I am joking around talking about can't get 16-year-olds to mow the grass, but here you are 17 already. I'm sure you by 15, 16, you were already looking into, you know, obviously that seed probably sprouts earlier than you just wake up one day at 17 and a half, say, got nothing to do tomorrow. I'll go join the service.
I think I knew I was going to join the service when I was about five. But yeah, you know, when you're young, dumb, and you know, there's a reason we send young men to war. Because men our age would say, no, heck no. But it's those young men that have to become, or boys that have to become men, that really define their generation based on what they did that they probably would not do at an older age or after they had children or things like that. So I think that's always an interesting dynamic when we talk about young people at war. It's a whole different dynamic for those younger people as opposed to you know, the 20-year veteran, you know, sergeant majors or colonels, that they're waging war in a much different way.
Yeah.
Than the guys on the front lines or in the mortar platoons.
So Jeff, you were still in high school then when you enlisted.
I signed my contract right before I was a senior in high school and went over and you know, we talk about that a lot on here. Was in basic when September 11th happened. So I have a pretty good idea of that peacetime to wartime, you know, transition overnight. So I'm really, really looking forward to more of your story here because, man, you know, just earlier today, if our listeners just Google what happened on December 7th, right, it's going to be Pearl Harbor. Go to history.com, go to libraryofcongress.com. It's going to say the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Or you might even get December 7th was also interesting because that's the date that America declared war on Austria-Hungary in 1917. But it's so much more than that, and it's so enlightening to me to know that you've put together this work for people to enjoy the rest of the story. You know, it's just Pearl Harbor was one of those puzzle pieces that really I think people need to understand to really appreciate America's involvement and what drew us in and what really happened. It boggles my mind that the stand at Wake or female nurses in Corregidor being among the first POWs, how do those things get lost in the sauce behind the Battleship Arizona, right? And of course, not to take away from that tragedy, but it was a series of tragedies, and you have to understand it to know the full story.
There are various theories on what was actually in the mind's eye of Imperial Japan, right? I think it's safe to say it was a coordinated attack to take all of the Pacific Rim, and they were heading for Australia. That was the big prize. And then once they had all that, nothing was going to stop them.
You know, kind of Jeff's question, why does one aspect of the war seem to get so much light shined onto it opposed to other? And this is me just totally talking out my rear end here, because it just popped in my head. With the exception of Wake Island, because I actually had a film crew there, I think a lot of that has to do with the amount of video footage that was readily available to television show producers in the 70s and 80s when before the History Channel came out, and people who were putting together documentaries. A lot of the stuff was still, classified. You couldn't just go down there and get all this military video footage. And so I think a lot of the stuff that we know nowadays, at least in pop culture, people who don't read books like we do, I mean, we can see the ones behind Jeff, but just your everyday regular Joe Schmoes in the world, I think they get most of their history from what was on TV. And what was on TV was produced based around the footage that people can acquire to put on TV. I mean, how many times have you watched a show about a particular conflict, Marine Corps, for example, or I was actually watching something getting up to speed on Bataan Death March in the Battle of the Philippines, and for a split second, I could have sworn, like, they cut to a clip, black and white clip of Vietnam, because it looked like a barrel of an M16. It's like, wait a minute, that doesn't belong. So I think, and you'll see it from time to time, where they're talking about Marine Corps, and all of a sudden you'll see a soldier and army uniform walking by. It's like, oh, the guy editing the video doesn't know the difference. But I wonder if a lot of what we know, especially growing up in the 70s and 80s, is because of what was available to television production crews. It's just a hypothesis.
It's a great question, yeah. I know... from having interviewed veterans in both theaters, I was talking to Shifty Powers before he passed. Probably half a dozen times we got to talk
I'm so jealous. I would have let him in a fly on the wall just listen to any one of his stories.
He was amazing, and he would call me up, which was the crazy thing. Like, who am I? But he would call me up and just say, "Yeah, I had a good day," He was housebound at the end, and the cancer was really getting to him, and he had time on his hands. He would listen to books on tape, and if he had a really good day, he would go on his back porch and shoot his M1 at targets he had there in his backyard, which was just amazing. But, Shifty, the big thing he was known for was his empathy. And there's that classic scene in Band of Brothers where he talks about how this man, he was just doing his job. This man on the other side, this enemy. But under different circumstances, we would have been good friends. And I think a lot of the vets, anyway, in the European theater that I've talked to, certainly there were gritty parts of that battle, absolutely, or of that war, that side of the war. But there was a sense of, okay, the war's over, and now let's just get back to our jobs and get back to our homes and start our families and buy that refrigerator and get on with life. A contrast to the veterans that I've talked to and interviewed who have fought in the Pacific, R.V. Bergen, to name a name, and he went on the record with this, just saying, man, he would never own a Japanese car. There was still a sense of, I'm not going to forgive. There was too much that went down. And I don't trust them today. I mean, that was RV's big stance, right or wrong. But it was a grittier, more difficult, more, I don't know. I struggle with the adjectives there because, what happened in Europe was horrific stuff. But the guys in the Pacific, that's my observation anyway. When they came back, I could name half a dozen guys who took that same stance as RV that bygones weren't bygones. It was grittier, tougher stuff.
You think barbaric would be a good adjective?
Yeah.
It's not funny, but it strikes a memory when you say that. I grew up, I was born in 78. Karate Kid was out. At the time there was a lot of, Asian culture that was seeping into pop culture and all that. I remember I went to the Richwood Flea Market in Kentucky as a young kid and watching all these karate movies and all that. I saw this really cool bandana, had a red circle on it, some scribbles on it, and I wanted it, and I bought it, and I wore it in my grandmother's house. My grandfather did grave registration in Europe, and my grandmother was upset, was a light adjective to use. She wanted that bandana nowhere in her house because she couldn't prove what was written on it because she didn't understand the language. And I didn't understand at the time why. My mom was like, hey, it's different times. Times are different. You know, it's just from the flea market. He likes it, Karate Kid, all that stuff. And, you know, all these years later, like you were just saying, you know, even though my grandfather fought in Europe, I'm sure she had family members, boys from the town who went to her school who died in the Pacific. And even in 1984, she still kind of had that same feeling of don't quite trust it.
And I definitely saw that through my dad's eyes. And you know, I remember in the 80s, because I loved Karate Kid, and that, you know, when the Hachimakis were real popular there for, you could go in any mall and see stuff like that. And, you know, my dad didn't like it. I mean, he was not shy about expressing his opinion on it. Mm.
And I'm sure a lot had to do with the fanaticism on the, you know, the side of the Japanese soldiers and the things they saw, the mutilation of bodies and all that stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things that goes along with war. So when you were coming to research and maybe plan to roll out your latest novel, how did you settle or come to the story of the three gentlemen that you highlight in the book, The Long March Home? How did this particular project come to your light, and how did you settle on it and proceed to go down this path?
So it all started in real life with Lieutenant Buck Compton. He started it all, which is kind of a funny story, but I did Buck's book back in, it was like 06, 07, Call of Duty was called. And Buck was, he was really my teacher, my mentor, my professor. I came in pretty dumb to the whole subject, and he gave me a great education. And the cool thing was it continued even after his book was finished. Buck was 85 when I helped him write his memoirs, and he was still in pretty good health, still traveling all over the country to various shows, and he was still speaking. And so his daughter, Tracy Compton, who's just a great person and a great friend of mine, she called me up after his book came out and said, hey, you know, my dad could use some help navigating airports. Would you like to travel with my dad?
That's a nice assignment.
One of these questions that just comes along, you know, once in a lifetime. I'm like, absolutely. So I ended up doing three trips with Buck. And he had a really great memory, particularly for things that happened, you know, in the war years and surrounding that. Sometimes he couldn't remember what happened yesterday, but, you know, that's me as well today. So we'd be sitting in an airport just waiting for a plane, and he would have just minuscule detail of things that he could recall from what happened in, you know, 42 and 43. So we're sitting in an airport one day, and he's talking about Bastogne, you know, and I'm just sort of all ears, and he's, you know, it's just this winter hell, and guys are, you know, no boots, and Joe Lesniewski has wrapped his feet in burlap bags, very literally, and that's how he's gone to combat, and there's not enough food, and they're eating this bean soup with maggots in it, and just, you know, tough time, Belgium's coldest winter in 30 years. So I'm just sitting there going, man, Buck, wow. This must have been so hard for you to be in Bastogne. And when I say that, Buck stops and he kind of looks at me and he goes, yeah, we had it rough. And then he says, but we didn't have it as rough as the guys in the Pacific. They had it really rough. So that statement stays with me for years. And I'm kind of going, what does he mean by that? And so I read Donald Knox's Death March Oral History Project when the guys are about 65, so they're really fresh there, and that was my introduction to the subject. And then Adam Makos did, and I worked on Voices of the Pacific together, where we interviewed all the guys from K35, and that really brought me face to face with just many of these men. And but I still I was looking for that story surrounding the Bataan Death March. I got a chance to interview some vets who had been there, but their their story just wouldn't work out for a whole book. And so I began to dream of this book, where I could take readers into the heart of the action. Like, I love oral history. I've done oral history projects, but kind of the limitation of oral history is that you often get kind of the treetop view, as opposed to a really good movie or a really good narrative, nonfiction or a novel, which really just plunges you deep into the heart of the action. So that's what I really began to dream of. And, I began to work on this book, that eventually became Long March Home. I worked on it for 7 years. It was a back burner passion project. It was unfunded at the start. So I was just working on it in sort of pieces, little by little. Got a manuscript done. This was 5-6 years ago. And I sent it out to some early readers just to get their perspective. And the feedback that came back to me was, yeah, it was good. It was really good. But it wasn't great. Not great yet. And I wanted it to be great. I wanted it to move from that sort of that B plus level to an A plus level. Because the guys are worth it, right? I wanted to shine the spotlight on what they had done, and I really wanted to elevate it. So I called my agent, we talked it through, and he's like, here's the deal. you're writing fiction in this case based on history. More women buy fiction than men. And this book and the subject matter is so gritty. Talk to a female novelist. Get her on board. Get her take. And how can you make this sort of palatable for everybody? And palatable is the wrong word, but you want a story that's just blood and guts to not be blood and guts all the time.
Sure.
So I called up my friend Tosca Lee, and I had read a number of her books, and she had endorsed a book for me a number of years earlier. So we were both kind of familiar with each other's writing styles and whatnot. And I said, how'd you like to write a book with me about the Bataan Death March? And this was her statement. She goes, what? What is the Bataan Death March? And this started the conversation, where I explained a little bit of it to her, and then I kind of sent her some nonfiction books to read. And she was aghast. She was like, exactly what we're talking about here today. She's like, why have I never heard about this ever? What's the deal? Why are we not teaching this in schools? It's such a big piece of our history and a key piece of our history. And Tosca's like, and I've never heard about it. So that lit a fire underneath her to go, okay, we have to educate people about this period of history. If I don't know about it, and she was in her late 40s at the time, yes, we have to start talking about it. She took my existing manuscript. She worked on it for a couple of years because she was in the midst of a different project at the time. She finally got it to a stage where she was happy with it, and she knew her readership would be happy with it. And then we started working on it back and forth just to get it all into one voice. And finally, this book is out there, and the reviews are coming back. We've got three distinct starred reviews from Publishers Weekly, Booklist, Library Journal. Extremely hard to get. We feel strongly that this book has become an A-plus piece, that we are truly honoring the vets who are there, and it was our best work to get out there.
And so the book is based around three friends from Mobile, Alabama, and their trip of enlisting into the service and then going over to the Philippines and then surviving the death march, the ships, internment in Japan, basically the whole gambit. And like you say, and that's kind of a hard task to ask someone who's not familiar with a particular subject, hey, here's a subject. Maybe some of the reasons it's not covered in wide swath is because of the brutality. And it's, yes, it's war, but it's really truly a study on how humans treat other humans in the worst possible environment and condition of war. And how do you take such a rough, raw subject matter and make it, as you said, palatable, but not take away the severity and the importance of that brutality? Because it's that brutality that makes that story so important to tell. And how do you do that in a way where you maintain its importance and the severity of it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a question we talked about for probably a year. I mean, just trying to ask that question. And the challenge is if you just have in a story brutal, then you become desensitized to it as a reader, as a viewer even. And so one of the things we did was we created a separate storyline that happens on the home front. So that's three best friends and then the girl they leave behind back home. And we weave this other story in to the death march accounts. And so you'll read a bit about the death march and then you'll go back to Alabama for a while and then go back to the death march. And the effect it creates is like you can take it, like you can take the grit and then you get a little respite and then you can take some more of the grit. And, you know, we are hearing a little bit of criticism that it's still a little bit too gritty. I mean, yeah, and we tried to pare it back enough just to make it so you could get into it. So I think it works. And the real critics, you know, the critics who do it for a living, they're saying it does work. It's some bloody stuff, absolutely.
Well, maybe there's a little bit of benefit that this book came out in a time where the number one core audience to true crime stories and true crime novels are women. And so they kind of got a little bit of a foundation of reading gritty raw material, you know, and so it may lend it a little bit, you know, of ease of maintaining one's ability to make it through the harder pages to get back to the flashbacks. And that's probably kind of nice too, is it's almost, you know, as you're saying, you read through the gritty stuff and then here, okay, we're going to take two chapters to go back and kind of fresh your palate a little bit and then, you know, let your heart rate lower down and kind of get to know these guys on a personal level. And that probably building that personality and the character development and that personal level makes it even harder to imagine these people going through such horrible events to them, opposed to just three random people that, here's three names that we really don't know thrown in a situation. But when you build that character behind it, and then they can imagine those people going through that, it's got to make it that much more relatable and heartfelt.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great point right there. When I, in my original manuscript, I started the book on the march itself. And then Tosca came along and said exactly what you said. It's like, now we got to get to know these guys a little bit better. And so, you know, I'm thinking campaign. I'm thinking let's dive into the action. And she's like, no, it'll be actually more powerful if we know who these guys are. And even the Bataan Death March, I mean, just to understand what that was all about. So April 1942, the Allied troops surrender on the Philippines. Now, they keep fighting for another month on Corregidor, right, the island that's right off the coast there. But for the troops who are on the Bataan Peninsula in the Philippines, their combat days, so to speak, are over. They are ordered to lay down their weapons and surrender. And there's some good reasons for it. I mean, it was hopefully to prevent more bloodshed. And that's probably another whole discussion right there. But anyway, so the troops are rounded up on the peninsula because they're not all fighting together. They're kind of fighting in sort of spread out pockets. And so Imperial Japan, they round up the Allied troops and then they begin to march them up the peninsula to these POW camps. For the guys on the bottom of the peninsula, it's about 66 miles and it takes almost a week. If you're farther north, you're not marching as far, but you're still marching, you know, 3, 4, 5 days. But the brutality on the march itself is that, and even to put yourself in the eyes of the enemy, they're going, holy cow, this huge army has just surrendered, because there's another probably 50, 60,000 Filipino troops, they're surrendering as well. And suddenly we've got to deal with them. And our superiors are telling us, show no mercy, and don't share your food. And in that mindset, if you surrendered, you were considered a coward, and there was no respect for troops who surrendered.
That's what I want to put a, that's what I want to put a fine point on for our audience who aren't familiar with the mindset of Imperial Japan. You know, being asked to put down your weapons, you think, okay, cool, they're happy, we're no longer. No, you're now you're a coward, and now we got to deal with you. And to surrender to a military that frowns upon surrendering because you're a coward and dishonor your people, they're not going to treat you nicely because, okay, you're no longer shooting us. Now we're going to, now that you're dealing with somebody who has a complete lack of respect for you.
It's a perfect storm. It's the worst of the worst. And so these Allied troops, as they're being marched up to these POW camps, there are indiscriminate beheadings, beatings. If a man falls out of line, he's stabbed with the end of his bayonet. There are convoys of Imperial Japanese soldiers who are driving up next to these marching soldiers, and they would stick a rifle butt out of the end of the truck and just sort of take a whack at a soldier's head as he's walking. It's like playing baseball with mailboxes. Just horrific stuff. Some men were mowed down by rifle fire. Some men were mowed down by tanks. You know, as they went alongside of the troops. If you stop to, and the men, they're emaciated, and many of them are sick. If you got out of line to take a crap by the side of the road, you were shot. I mean, this is tough stuff. And person after person is falling and dying, and it's just a horrible time for sure.
And oh, by the way, they're not marching 100 kilometers in a nice pair of Brooks or New Balance shoes. They cut on, you know, old ragged boondockers with socks that are all, you know, blisters on their feet and dry conditions. And just if you did come across water and you quote unquote smuggled it, you can easily be beheaded for it. I mean, so even if you're trying to do your best to maintain your health so you can do what you're being asked to do, then you're punished for that too. And so it's truly a no-win situation for these guys.
The rules were changing. The rules were being made up on the spot. Even if you're trying to sort of keep the rules that your new captors were giving you, those rules were hard to figure out. And there's a language issue. There's a language barrier. You name it. It is tough stuff.
And even though the history and the category is titled the Bataan Death March, the march in and of itself is just the beginning of the nightmare. Once they got to the camp, you know, which was an old army base, the living conditions there were horrible.
Yeah. There's any number of camps, but one of the main ones is Camp O'Donnell, which is, you do hear about Camp O'Donnell every once in a while. And conditions there are pretty lousy. A couple thousand guys are being crammed into this facility. And the prisoners are given various work details by their captors. And sometimes the men are outside gathering firewood. Sometimes they're growing crops, although most of the food is being given to Imperial Japan and not the prisoners themselves. Some of the guys are put on burial detail because the deaths in the camp are just growing so much. And so they are carting dead bodies outside of the camp every day and burying them just by the hundreds. Just some crazy stuff that's happening in the camps.
How many, you know, you just alluded to the fact, Marcus, that there Camp O'Donnell was not the only camp. Do you know how many there were?
I forget the exact count. Yeah. And that's a good point, Henry, because some camps, and so I say this carefully, some camps were better than others. Now right. They're all bad. I think sure. We have to get that. But yeah, some camps, like Bilibid Prison was actually one of the better places, in the heart of the city there. And Bilibid was considered better because they had some better medical facilities there. Mm-hmm. There were some American doctors and medics that were still allowed to practice. And they didn't have very much supplies, but they were still sort of given, like if a man was sick at Bilibid, he might get better.
Mm-hmm.
One of the fields was the name is just escaping me. It's where the international airport sits today. The name's going to come to me at like 3 a.m. It'll be like, why didn't I say Nichols Field? Okay, so Nichols Field was probably a step beyond Camp O'Donnell in terms of bad situations. Mm-hmm. So at Nichols, they were tasked with constructing an airstrip, and they were constructing this airstrip by hand. So it's this big hill of dirt and rocks and gravel, and the prisoners are ordered to, they're given shovels. I mean, this is not backhoe stuff. They're given, you know, railway cars and picks and shovels and told to move this hill by hand.
Yeah.
So this is kind of dawn to dusk, backbreaking work. The Japanese want to construct this airstrip sort of as quickly as possible so they can, you know, land bigger planes and whatnot. And so the supervisors, they're getting a lot of pressure from their supervisors to hurry things up. And if a man was working at Nichols Field, yeah, he didn't last very long. So, yeah, there were some better camps than others, although they're all bad.
Well, I think when it comes down to the level of better versus bad, probably had a lot to do with the amount of people crammed into it. I know the prison you spoke of earlier, one of the bigger problems they had was lack of latrine facilities. And the video I was watching earlier talking about they had so many people in there, some of them were forced to live right by the trenches that they used for latrines, and the waste was so bad that flies just engulfed the entire camp. And so if you're one of these guys who are stuck sleeping near the quote-unquote latrine, you're just covered in flies as well because of the amount of, you know, infestation just from not having a simple place way to dispose of human waste. And so the quote-unquote less bad of your camp may just depend on, hey, we got 1,000 less guys here to deal with, you know, that sort of thing. So, and then if you survived that, then you got put on a ship and sent to Japan. And so it's like one after the other. It's like, okay, I survived this horror. Maybe things are going to get better. No, it's going to continue to get worse for you. And so they had these transport ships that were basically turned into troop carriers out of old cargo ships, and they're just crammed in there. And you had to hope you didn't get sunk by Allied submarines and survive the horrible situations on those ships.
Yeah, sometimes when people hear this story, they will stop at this place and become really skeptical. And they'll say, there's no way that all this stuff mm-hmm. happened to the same people. No way. But they forget that actually, yeah, it happened over years. And yes, things went from bad to worse to horrible to whatever happens after horrible. It was just crazy the amount of atrocities that were sort of heaped on the same amount of people. So yeah, you've been working as a POW a number of years, you're sick, you're starved, and now you get put on this ship and sent to the mainland of Japan, where you got to go work in a mine or a factory for Imperial Japan. Now, this is toward the end of the war, but the guys don't know it yet, right? Nobody knows it yet. But particularly the guys on the ground, because they don't get any news. And so they're put on these ships, and they're crammed in these ships. And many of these ships have just been used to transport horses and cattle and whatnot, and now they're being used to transport men. So there's still manure in the bottom of these things, and there's no ventilation, and there's maybe a bucket of water that's lowered down, you know, twice a day, and maybe a bucket of rice. We're talking for like 2,000 guys.
2,000 guys with compromised immune systems who are already, I mean, it's one thing.
Dysentery.
It's one thing to take a healthy person right off the battlefield and put them in that situation. But as you stated before, guys who've already experienced these horrible things and who've already probably lost 30, 40 pounds, they have compromised immune systems, they're already starving, they're already dehydrated. And then to be put in those situations, it's just every one of them,
they would pass bodies up out of the hole just to get these corpses out of their you know, living conditions. And they're crammed in so tightly that they can't even sit on the floor. They're sort of belly to back and just such hard places. And then the tragedy of this is that if you're transporting prisoners and you're abiding by the Geneva Convention, you have to announce to the enemy that you're transporting prisoners. Mm-hmm. But of course, Japan doesn't abide by that. And so here come these American planes, and they spot Japanese ships, and they're bombing the Japanese ships, and it's you know, friendly fire, not knowing that there are Allied troops in deep in the holes of these ships.
Yeah, because they don't even so much as put a Red Cross on them, let alone a POW symbol or anything of that nature.
Yeah,
and
is it known how many of those ships were sunk?
Yeah, I couldn't tell you offhand, but it was more than one. It was a lot. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the living conditions on those ships were so bad that pretty much history as a whole refers to them as hell ships, because that's what they were, living hell. And so if anyone listening is wanting to do some research on some of the questions we've asked or, you know, haven't heard of these particular atrocities, just Google hell ships of World War II and you'll find a lot of content on the horrors that went on these boats. And so when it came to researching, and because obviously, as you stated before, you got fictional characters in a historical environment. When it comes to researching something like the Bataan Death March, what were some of the key places and key source materials you used to make sure that the historical aspects of this story were historically correct?
Yeah. I'm going to turn my camera just slightly so you can see. I mean, just even on the top of my bookshelf there, that's two stacks of three rows deep. That's my Pacific collection at the moment.
Nice.
So you want to read as much as you can, and then talk to anybody. In the last 3 months, I've talked to two veterans, and they were 101 and 103. So there is this imperative that while we still have this generation with us, I want to talk to as many as I can.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, yeah. Whatever you can read on the subject and whatever you can, and whoever you can talk to.
You know, and that's another thing. When we think of survivors of war, whether it's Vietnam, World War II, modern day wars, we often think of the men who suffer physical wounds and obviously emotional wounds as well. But perfect example, the men who survived this triathlon of horrors, the physical ailments that they had to live with the rest of their lives that weren't visual. You know, it's not, oh, he has a missing leg, missing arm. It's the diseases or illnesses that came later in life due to their compromised immune systems that they had for all those years and you know, things that have come to them, you know, passing away at an early age because of, you know, their body trying to survive all those years after the war, what they had to experience. I'm sure so many of them probably passed away at a quote unquote earlier age because of the hardship that their body went through to keep them alive and their willpower that they had to stay alive through all of that.
Yeah. So Joe Johnson, the vet who I mentioned earlier, when he came back from the Philippines, I have some pictures of him right when he got back to the States. Now, he came back in pretty rough shape. He had a leg wound that was needing a lot of attention. He was in the hospitals for about a year after he came home. But I don't know, sort of darkly telling are the pictures of him when he first comes back, because he's been, after being released, he's been eating sort of as much as he can every day. And in these pictures, he's swollen up. And he looks like he's probably like he's 20 years older than he truly is, because his body just can't handle this sort of massive influx of calories. And eventually, he does sort of even out. But that first year back out of captivity is just so rough on his system. He was 6'4", and he had gone down to 110, 109 pounds, I think was his lowest.
So, that like strikes home for me, because I'm 6'5", and my walking around weight is about 227. So to think of being in the hundreds, I can only imagine. That is tremendously skinny.
Yeah.
It's absurdly skinny.
And Marcus, I'm curious. You know, I think we've pounded the brutality of this subject to a pretty good level here. I'm just curious, without giving too much away, because of course we want everybody to read your book, The Long March Home. But did you find in your research, was there ever this little twinkle of empathy found somewhere in some possibility with the Japanese? Was there ever any kind of a human element that you came across, that this, we know that this is brutal. We, you know, even a novice historian, it may have just heard of the Bataan Death March, thinks, oh, it's a bunch of guys that suffered, you know, we don't even have to go into a very deep level, I think, to get an understanding of how terrible this is. But was there ever this surprise factor in your research? Like, wow, this is even more surprising than how brutal it was. Did you ever come across anything like that?
Yeah, that's great, Jeff. And thanks for bringing us back there. Certainly in The Long March Home, we write a lot about the friendship between the three guys and what went on between them. And just, yeah, there's some funny moments, and sometimes just laughter brings you out. When I was talking to, or when I was researching Joe Johnson as well, and his sense of humor buoyed him along so many places. And there were the occasional compassionate Japanese guard. Like we can't sort of paint every individual within this system as all bad, because they weren't. There were compassionate guards, and there were guards who liked to, you know, walk along whistling "My Blue Heaven," because that's a detail that was true to life. And in Joe Johnson's case, he was beaten once and just about dead. And this guard came to him and said, you know, look, I've got a boy at home. I've got a son at home who's just about your age. And I know how much I want to get home so I can see him. So imagine your parents now, because they want you to get home so they can see you again. And this guard, this Japanese guard, really encourages Joe along and just says, you know, get up. If you show your captors, me included, that you're strong and you can survive this beating, everybody's going to respect you more, and it's actually going to go better for you. And this kind of the strange compassion of the guard gets Joe up and keeps him going.
That's outstanding. Yeah, I was thinking too, and this may be a subject for a whole other episode, but in talking with the veterans that you have and the research you've done, has the topic ever come up about the lack of Japanese that came, were charged with any kind of war crime? When we think about, of course, with the Germans and the atrocities in Europe, has that ever been kind of one of those, you know, sore subjects with the guys that did survive this, to get that final retribution, to see these guys kind of really pay? Has that ever come up in any of your findings as well?
Yeah, it's controversial for sure. I mean, because some of the guys, some of the Japanese soldiers were put through the war crimes trials. Exactly what Japan admits to these days is also controversial. And we've got that an author's note in the end of The Long March Home that talks about how there have been some apologies, and there have been some retractions, and yeah, it's tough to say what sticks for sure.
Yeah, it's.
I was going to ask that too. On that same note of the acknowledgement on the part of the Japanese, you know, if there's been much on that. But sorry, Don, didn't mean.
No, that's a good point. I was going to go a little off subject, but kind of subject with the things that Japan may rightfully so want to not acknowledge versus the stuff that they just want to ignore. And I think it's probably 10 years ago now. I think somewhere in California, someone put together a, don't know if monument's the proper word, but it was a statue to make people aware of, quote unquote, the capture and use of comfort women by the Japanese. And when that monument was put out, Japan was really up in arms about, hey, this isn't something we're proud about, but, you know, this organization in California, because of the amount of, you know, Japanese immigrants who lived in California at the time, you know, they wanted this known that, you know, the Chinese population in California, they wanted it known what was done with their women during the war. And that's just another one of those things that Japan doesn't really want to come clean about. And so they were really up in arms about this monument, this thing that came out about the comfort women that were enslaved into the sex trade.
So, yeah, I remember that when they came out. And comfort women, it is a subject that it needs to be talked about. It's difficult as well, because there are any number of other countries who were, when they were imprisoned, groups of their women were put into this program, for want of a better word. And Chinese and Vietnamese and Thailand and you name it. And the comfort women, they were it was servitude, a sex slave, mostly for the Japanese soldiers, a bit for their civilian population as well, and horrific stuff. No age requirements. I mean, we're talking kids as young as 12, maybe younger. Who quite knows. And sometimes it wasn't necessarily even prostitution, although that was part of it. It was like they would sort of crazy stories. Like they would put a naked comfort woman at the head of a column of soldiers. If that column was really tired, if they've been marching for days on end, we're talking Japanese soldiers. And they would think that, okay, if a naked woman is ahead of them, then these guys are going to march a little bit stronger. They're going to keep going. Crazy stuff like that, and it would often be through the territory of a captured country. So we go capture Thailand. We're going to take a woman from Thailand and sort of put her at the head of this group of soldiers, and it's her countrymen who are seeing her. So.